You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I'm really excited about the guest I have here with me this weekend, Congressman Thomas Massie from Kentucky. Congressman, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me on, Brad.
So for my many listeners who probably know you, you are more on the libertarian, kind of maverick, civil libertarian side of the Republican Party. So one of the issues I wanted to talk to you about was, you know, I don't want to rehash what happened on January 6th. Everyone agrees it was bad and wrong. But I want to talk about the fallout after that fact, because some of your colleagues in Congress, including bipartisan legislators, have started talking about the need for new surveillance laws to crack down on so-called domestic terrorists. In fact, they introduced a bill exactly to this effect. So I guess, Congressman, my first question is, are you worried that the aftermath of this really unfortunate incident will be used to crack down on the civil liberties of Americans?
Yes, I'm absolutely worried. I mean, the presence of troops outside my office, which is ringed by razor wire and walls, is very disturbing, not because it frightens me, but because I think it's meant to scare other people. It's meant to project an image on the news every night that our capital is under imminent threat of attack from extremists, homegrown terrorists, for instance. My problem is, I think they're probably, for some Democrats, that definition includes 75 million people who voted for President Trump. And it certainly includes some of the members of the military. I mean, the Democrats, they've defined domestic terrorists so broadly that they're worried that they have domestic terrorists guarding them right now, which I think is an insult to our troops who are doing their jobs. And it's also, it's sort of recursive. They're scaring themselves. The Democrats are scaring themselves with the image of soldiers right there as you walk into your office carrying M4s. They're convincing other members of the Democratic caucus that this is so serious that they better vote for these freedom-crushing bills, and they better get out there and promote the executive orders that are also going to emanate. But I think they'll use it to promote things like red flag laws. But we'll see. It's very disturbing to me.
So specifically talking about the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act introduced by Congressman Brad Schneider and a few others, they want new surveillance powers to crack down on domestic terrorists, like which you said they've defined very broadly. So a couple points on this. One, any potential domestic terrorist that wants to do an attack on the U.S. Capitol, existing law gives the government more than enough power to prosecute and stop them, right? And second, oh, yeah. How could these new powers be abused?
They have more than enough power. In fact, they have too much power right now as a result of the Patriot Act. There are banking laws, which are, some are connected to that and some are separate, where the banks have to disclose information about their clients to the government. And now we've seen here recently that Bank of America supposedly volunteered information about their customers and who, you know, was doing banking, for instance, in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. But they've got the power to do that already. They've got the FISA court where they can, you know, they can go in and get secret warrants on individuals. If those count as warrants, I don't think they do, you know, and they've just got way too much power already. They're harvesting data about your phone calls, content of your communications. They're storing that. They've already got all of that, but they say they need more now. And usually what happens when they pass these bills, like the Patriot Act, they're not written spur of the moment to deal with this. This is like a wish list, a goodie bag of infractions on your civil liberties that some of those charged with keeping the country safe would like to have.
So one thing that I really unfortunately get from a lot of young people who have grown up in the digital era and are just used to having essentially no privacy, they almost don't care. And they almost take the approach that I have nothing to hide. So whatever, if the FBI wants to listen to me through Alexa, so be it. why are they wrong? What, why could the, is even innocent people should feel threatened by these infringements, right? And why is that?
I don't know. I think some people feel like the government is like their doctor, that you could share your, you know, your deepest secrets with the government, and that's not an invasion of your privacy as long as your neighbor doesn't find out. In fact, I've had other congressmen say that, oh, we don't want to invade somebody's privacy. The only folks that will know about this are the government. The problem is, you may say something that you think is innocent, but then it becomes speech that's not acceptable to the government, and you've crossed some boundary without knowing it.
So you mentioned the Patriot Act, and I know you've done a lot of legislative work trying to roll back, you know, with your friend and former colleague, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, trying to roll back the overreaches that were passed in the Patriot Act after 9/11 and vastly expanded the federal government's surveillance powers. Do you see shades of that in what we're going through today?
Shades of rolling it back or shades of advancing?
No, shades of the similar pattern, right? Of the crisis being used to herald in these huge powers that were then mostly used for like drug prosecutions and not even terrorism. Do you see a similar dynamic playing out right now?
Oh, absolutely. That's what they're going to do. They're using the soldiers to motivate that, the constant barrage on the news of these images. And, you know, it's hard to imagine what other things they could do, you know, that they can't already do right now, things that they will add. But again, you've seen legislation already introduced for it. Don't trust me, trust them. Go read the legislation, go see what they're talking about. There may be executive orders issued. There may be secret executive orders issued. I actually wonder myself whether Twitter and some of the other social media companies weren't encouraged by the government to start banning individuals and to start taking away their accounts. You know, corporations, they hate risk because you know, the market will price risk at its worst. You know, they'll discount the stock if there's a risk of losing customers or losing revenue. And so corporations are risk averse. It seems like a very risky thing to me to just start kicking thousands of your customers or your users off of your platform, including somebody like the President of the United States. I just wonder, I can't prove this, but I just wonder if the corporations felt like their risk was mitigated because maybe the government, who is, let's be honest, partners with them. They sell to the government. They sell, you know, platforms and services to the government. I just wonder if the government didn't go to them and say, look, we've got your back. If you forestall, you know, what might be a domestic terrorist, then we will, by deleting their account, then we can produce in a secret court the evidence that you were justified in doing that. I think they're sort of already working together, not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but there are portions of our budget that go to the tech companies that aren't disclosed.
So that's interesting. And obviously we can't prove that they're chatting in their ear, but we can absolutely know that they are looming the big government hammer of, you know, regulation and antitrust and all these things. They're openly saying at these hearings, you better step up, Facebook, and do what we want, or we're going to use these policies. And that kind of brings me to another interesting point that I remember you making way back in March, I believe, when Congress was still passing the CARES Act, the $2 trillion plus huge government COVID relief bill. You predicted at the time that it was going to end up being a windfall to big corporations. Yes. And a lot of people really raised an eyebrow at that and said, what? This money's going to working families and to stimulus for the needy. But I feel like you've been pretty much vindicated in that. So could you talk a little bit about the ways in which the government's COVID response has been kind of crony and bent towards the well-off and well-connected?
Yeah, I said on March 27th that the $1,200 checks were the cheese in the trap, and that the trap was cronyism and to some degree socialism, but more so cronyism. Look, the stock market why should the stock market have done as great as it has done over the past 9 months when, you know, everything is shut down? Not everything. There's some companies that have actually benefited, like fast food companies have benefited from the regular restaurants being shut down. Pizza shops are doing great. But, you know, it's the exception, not the rule, that companies are economically better off because of COVID and because of the crackdown. Yet the stock market generally has gone up. You know, it's had one of its best years ever. How do you explain that? Well, it's because the policies that were implemented on March 27th were actually beneficial or more beneficial to the stock market than to individuals. And the government knew that at the time. That's why when they were giving checks to dead people, they didn't care, because they were actually going to their estates. And people were like, well, how does a dead person spend money? Well, it was the checks were addressed to the administrator of the estate, so that the money could actually get spent. It could go into the estate and then go into the economy. So they weren't really that interested in an equitable distribution of that money. By the way, the $1,200 checks, which were meant to compensate, you know, ostensibly meant to compensate people for damages incurred during COVID. Maybe they couldn't go to work or they had some other hardship. Why did they go to government employees who didn't miss a paycheck, didn't get a pay cut? The reason is, honestly, the $1,200 was more to stimulate the economy than it was to help individuals. And it did stimulate the stock market. But then there were other things that went to companies to stimulate those companies. And you see that going on. You'll see more of that in the next COVID bill. If you take the absolute number, whether it's $1 trillion or $2 trillion, and divide it by 300 million people in the United States, you won't get anything near the number of the amount of the checks that are going to go to individuals. It's because a large portion of that is going to go to somebody else.
Well, yeah, that is a good point. Where's all the money going? I saw the other day some statistic about how if you took all the money they want to send to state and local government bailouts, you could buy every homeless person a $200,000 house. Right. And obviously that's just a statistic off Twitter or something. But the point really is that a lot of this money went where we don't know that it goes. And a lot of times we see this during recessions, during crises, government really expanding and reaching into the economy and then not fully receding. So when it comes to things like, for example, in the CARES Act, they created this blown up, ultra generous, expanded welfare state of unemployment benefits. And it was supposed to be temporary, right? But now we're talking about extending it out through August, like over a year and a half or so later. Is there a problem here where COVID-19 is being used to usher in not permanent, not temporary, like Milton Friedman said, but permanent government programs into the economy that the American people never would have otherwise accepted?
Yeah, and before we get to the permanent programs, let me remind you that there was something called the PPP, which was to encourage employers to take the money to retain employees so that they wouldn't go onto unemployment. The problem is, I had people calling me up saying, am I reading this correctly? These are business owners. They're like, this is basically free money and I don't need it, but I'd be a fool not to take it. And so that's not to downplay the economic malady that's befallen restaurant owners, for instance, in Kentucky, some of who gone out of business because the PPP wasn't enough to compensate for their loss of business. But there were companies that they were like, I'd be a fool not to take it. So they took the PPP. Meanwhile, we've got this perpetual state. The governor here in Kentucky, even in December, shut down all indoor dining in Kentucky. And meanwhile, by the way, I've got one restaurant owner in Kentucky who stayed open during that period, was even served with criminal papers and still stayed open. Wow. Now, the criminal charges have been dropped, and that restaurant owner, I think it's going to be fine. But his point was, look, I've got employees and Christmas is coming up. I'm not going to let them go because our governor has really botched. There are tens of thousands of people who haven't gotten their unemployment. They can't sign up for it because it's such a massive inflow of unemployment claims that the governor can't keep up with. Our state auditor just revealed this week that there are 400,000 unread unemployment emails in Kentucky at the unemployment office. They just archived them from, instead of reading them, they had some between March and May and they put them in an archive. But so we've got those situations, but I do think we're gonna get some sort of steady state, diminished economy out of this. And, you know, it was sort of a test run for the Mincom there this summer when everybody got a check and then some of the unemployment benefits were so generous that people could leave work and make more money out of work than they did while working, depending on what their wage was. You know, when the federal government augmented the state unemployment programs, you had employers who were calling up people trying to get them to come back to work. Like, these are firsthand accounts that people were relating to me. I was getting texts from people in my district who said, I've got employees, they won't come back to work. They just tell me they can't afford to come back to work. They need this extra money that they're getting from unemployment. So definitely they got that wrong. But going forward, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I think we just need to open our economies back up. We need to open our schools right back up. There's almost no amount of stimulus that you could put out there that would compensate for somebody's full-time salary. I mean, if President Biden is talking about a $15 an hour minimum wage, what does that mean when you don't go to work and you're getting a $1,400 check? And in some instances, like here in the state of Kentucky, they've screwed up, you know, maybe 20% of people's unemployment claims. So they're not even getting unemployment.
So this is an interesting question that you just touched on briefly, right? Because to some extent, some of your colleagues in Congress seem to think that if they just add more zeros, they can stimulate this economy. But I would suggest, and I wonder if you agree with this, that you could pass a $100 trillion stimulus bill and it wouldn't stimulate an economy that's still heavily restricted and in some parts of the country locked down. Like, no amount of government spending can make a growing economy out of restricted business where people's livelihoods are still outlawed, right?
Yeah, my analogy is giving a blood transfusion to somebody with a severed artery. I mean, our economy is the patient and it's bleeding because of the governors. Thank goodness you've got a few governors like Ron DeSantis who've just, you know, opened their economies back up regardless of what the CDC is saying or regardless of what the government is saying, whether it's Joe Biden or whether it's Donald Trump, you know. They just say, look, we can't do this any longer. And I don't think everything's come home to roost yet on these state governments. They are running deficits that aren't disclosed, that aren't really known yet. And when the state of Kentucky actually pays out the unemployment claims that they're liable for, you're going to see that they just don't have the money to do it. It may be part of the reason they're so incompetent at it is they just don't have the money and they're trying to delay the payment, robbing Peter to pay Paul right now. Because the states have had diminished revenue, even though the stock market's gone up. When you shut down your businesses, well, there's occupational taxes that you're not getting. Now, they're still happy to collect property tax, but there are certain taxes that they can't collect. So, you know, there's bleeding in the economy, and you're right, Brad, no amount of blood transfusion is going to make the patient better. It may keep them alive for a while, but that's not how you fix the problem. And one thing that's certain to result, and I think we're going to see this, although, you know, sometimes I'm amazed that we don't see it, is inflation. That would be, if you did $100 trillion stimulus package, what you're going to see is inflation. You know, I thought at first, why would we send $1,200 checks to people who are on Social Security, for instance, right? I talked about government employees who haven't missed a paycheck. What about the people who are on fixed income? And that hasn't changed at all. Well, you could almost justify the $1,200 checks or the $600 checks or the $1,400 checks because of inflation. If, you know, even if you're on a fixed income, what the government has done with the stimulus package has diminished your buying power. Meanwhile, inventories are drying up because fewer people are going to work. And I think this is putting a upward pressure on prices. You're going to see this on gasoline. But also, you see this when in Bitcoin and again in the stock market. One of the reasons the stock market is going up is people don't want their money in dollars as the dollars are getting diluted and more of them are getting printed. In the last year, we've set a record in terms of government spending. Look, our discretionary budget, rough numbers, is about $1 trillion. Okay, if you take the entitlements, you know, maybe you get up to $4 trillion. But we added $2 trillion to that just in March alone. And then we've added, you know, about $1 trillion since then. And we're talking about adding $2 trillion. So in the course of a year, I mean, these numbers are mind-boggling. You're going to see the government spending be at record levels in the history of humankind in terms of the revenue they bring in versus the amount they spend. The deficit spending is just insane, and people aren't talking about it.
So let's talk about the deficit spending, because you're absolutely right. I mean, last year, we already had a very serious debt problem before the COVID-19 pandemic, but we just went out and accelerated it like crazy and totally blew it out with $3 trillion plus deficits. And now we're over 100% of our GDP in debt. But here's the interesting part, because you just brought up inflation. The reason that I guess we haven't had a debt crisis yet is because the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates so artificially low. And so if inflation really starts to rise and become a serious problem, they're going to have no choice but to raise those interest rates. And then are we finally going to have the chickens come home to roost on this massive debt problem that we've been building up for years?
Well, you know, our debt was about $20 trillion not too long ago, but now it's $25 trillion, $26 trillion, depending on this latest package, $27 trillion. It's grown so quickly. But I used to say when it was $20 trillion that if we had to pay 5% interest on that, that would be easy numbers, $1 trillion of interest per year. But now, with the debt, let's just say round number $25 trillion, it only takes 4% interest. If the government ever had to pay 4% interest on the money that we've borrowed, that would be $1 trillion a year. That's our entire discretionary budget. That's like all the roads and bridges, all of NASA, all of the military, everything except for Social Security and Medicare.
That's got to come from taxes, right?
It's got to come from somewhere. And so $1 trillion, that depletes all of your spending. It would wipe out everything, just the interest alone. And what happens is people raise interest rates, lenders raise interest rates when the risk of default gets greater. And so it's sort of a runaway condition. And we saw that in Puerto Rico, for instance, where they weren't able to borrow more money. And they wanted a federal bailout. But it could be, you know, that could be where we're headed. The question is, will people keep loaning us money at these interest rates? The fact that the crisis has been global has saved us somewhat, because there's not a better place to loan your money to yet, not a better country if you're looking to loan it to a country.
So to shift gears slightly and just look at the next couple of years, for at least the next 2 years, we're going to have Democrats in control of the White House and both chambers of Congress. What issue areas do you think are going to be most important for free market conservative Republicans like you to be out there and yelling stop on? What are the main policy issues you see coming that are the places to fight?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of executive orders, because Joe Biden has 4 years in office, regardless of what happens, whereas Congress only is guaranteed 2 years in the majority in both the Senate and the House. There's, you know, with it tied in the Senate, and Kamala Harris being the tiebreaker, one change, if one seat flips to Republican more so than Democrat in the midterms, then we control the Senate. And in the House, through redistricting alone, we can almost get back to a majority because there are a lot of red states that are going to correct the gerrymandered districts, and you could pick up Republican seats, or they may gerrymander on their own. And so I think that's the one thing when I look at the gun control proposals that are out there, the civil liberties infringements that are out there, the voting HR1, you know, changing the way we vote in this country. When you look at all of that and you realize that if they get rid of the filibuster, they can run the tables for 2 years, what keeps them from doing that? I think it's because they want 4 years, not 2 years. That's the only thing that's going to moderate them right now in the next 2 years, is their desire to win the midterm election if they go too far on any one thing. So that's why, if he can do it by executive order, I think you're going to see Joe Biden do it by executive order.
So even in the House, the majority that the Democrats have, I don't remember the exact number, I'm sure you do, but it's not very large. It's still somewhat slim. Aren't there enough Democrats who are somewhat moderate in purple seats who are worried about reelection that you guys could pick them off and stop some of this stuff from passing the House?
That's true. And it's also the case in the Senate. I mean, you have Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in the Senate. So that will moderate them some, the fact that their majorities are so slim, you know, not just because they're afraid of losing them, but because you do have a few Democrats in there. But ultimately, probably that just means they have a better negotiating position for their yes vote. And, you know, that is a good point. That could moderate them. But what you have, what I've discovered in the House of Representatives, especially over the course of 8 years, you used to have some moderate Democrats, and those moderate Democrats are gone. You still have moderate districts, but you don't have moderate Democrats in those moderate districts. By moderate districts, I mean districts that are won or lost by less than 5% either way. In some cases, less than 1,000 votes. Okay, but the people who are getting elected in those districts aren't really representative of those districts. They're not necessarily moderates because they won the primary, and you know, the left. And you have this to some degree also in Republican primaries, but less so, I think. On the left has been going further left in their primaries, and then they get to the general and they win those toss-up seats. So, you know, to sort of couch that a little bit with what you said, there aren't as many moderates as you think. They're in moderate districts, but they're not that moderate.
If you had to, I know that you were good friends and worked a lot with Congresswoman Gabbard, who was a Democrat and fairly progressive. Is there anybody in the new Congress or in Congress now on the Democratic side of the aisle, if you had to pick out a few names who you think, maybe they're not moderate, but at least on some issues, you'll be able to work together and you think they will protect civil liberties and advance freedom?
You know, I don't know about the freshmen on the Democrat side of the aisle. I'm still trying to meet all the Republican freshmen, and I'm excited about them. But there are some Democrats who I can work with, who I've worked with over the years, like Shelley Pingree from Maine. We worked together on food freedom issues. And even some of the really, really liberal Democrats can be good on certain issues. And I hope people don't get mad at me for, you know, mentioning these Democrats, but you know, Zoe Lofgren can be good on civil liberties, and some of the Democrats can be, if it's freedom of speech, for instance, but that's more about the districts they represent. Bobby Scott, I've worked with him on criminal justice reform. And maybe those Democrats are saying, well, that's Massey is a Republican that we can work with to advance the things that we want to advance. But the reality is not all of these issues fit tightly into the Republican or the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And I think at this show, we try not to be partisan and we try to really advance on the issues. And we need more of that in Congress. So I think that's a good place to leave our serious conversation. And so, Congressman Massey, it is time for the part of the show that my listeners look forward to the most. They get to hear people's controversial food hot takes. Your friend Rand Paul was on here and told us how much he hates mayonnaise. Steve Forbes came on here and told us that he likes sandwiches with peanut butter and bacon. So you've got some tough competition, Congressman, but hit us with your most controversial food take.
Oh, gee, I like food so much. I can't think of a food I dislike. I like liver and onions, for instance, chicken liver, beef liver. I know a lot of people don't go for that. One of my most controversial food takes, I don't know if it's about eating food, but I think you're safer buying food straight from a farmer than you are buying USDA inspected food because there's accountability there. So that would be my controversial take, I guess.
Okay. All right, Congressman, thanks so much for your time and have a good week out there with all the chaos that's going on the Hill.
All right. Thanks, Brad.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.